1045 The Zone, hitting the links with you on a Saturday morning. This is Talking Golf with Virgil Herring on 1045 The Zone.
Good morning. It's time to talk a little golf, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 1045 The Zone. Got a great show lined up for us today. A little instruction heavy. We have two of the best teachers in the country coming on. Louis Sauer from Chicago and Nick Bradley will be joining us to discuss what we're watching at Riviera this week. And Nick's going to talk about his new book. And another book, Dr. Rob Bell's got his 28th book coming out. All of them bestsellers. So we'll talk with Dr. Rob Bell at the end of the show. And getting our show started off, batting first today. We moved him up in the lineup. Is the founder of Global Golf Post. We're going to write Monday's headlines even earlier than before. Jim Nugent. Nugent, how are you today, buddy?
Virgil, I'm good. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for putting me in the leadoff position. I didn't know you had such great introductory music in the Rolling Stones.
Yes, sir. And, well, you deserve it, man. You need every once in a while, we just got to shake the lineup up and put my Ricky Henderson out first. So we're not out of the gate. Riviera, once again, shows that great architecture and legendary design can stymie even the best as it pertains to the equipment and the players that we have today. And it also generally brings out the best players in the world, and it's doing it one more time. Talk to us about Riviera, the power that Riviera is, and as it pertains to a golf course that's, you know, hosted the legends for many, many years. And what we're watching this week, and it's probably, I've never seen it play as firm and fast as it has. So this is a great show for Riviera.
Yeah, I'm guessing without knowing that they've had a brilliant winter season, because oftentimes Riviera, it sits down low in a kind of a basin. It can be quite wet, but it's not. And so I imagine it's just because they've had a brilliant winter. You know, there's maybe a dozen times on the PGA Tour where strategic design negates distance. And this is one of those really great weeks where it happens. And it just happens to also occur in a tournament where you've got an absolutely brilliant field, maybe arguably the best field that what you and I once knew as the LA Open has ever had. Now, part of that is due to Tiger Woods getting involved with his foundation, and he's transformed it into not just a typical PGA Tour event, but an invitational. So it's got a smaller field, a bigger purse, a longer exemption period for the winner. All of the elements have come together to make this certainly the best week of the year on tour so far. But you just have to marvel at this golf course designed by George Thomas. It rewards shot making. It rewards strategy. It rewards people that know how to play angles and players that know how to think. And as we talk about distance with the USGA and the R&A, sometimes that we forget that distance isn't the only issue, but strategy is a really important element in our game, and we're seeing it this week.
Yeah, and one of the more popular arguments that I think people glance over, because the PGA Tour is now a gigantic business, is the fact that they always clamor for these great golf courses, but not many of these great golf courses have the entire package that it requires to have parking and all the tents and all of the festivities that the PGA Tour brings to the table. There, obviously, Riviera can, but there are some golf courses in cities that don't have, like the great golf courses around the world, don't have the space and what is required now to have a PGA Tour event. Because they're always talking about, why don't we have more tournaments at like a Royal Melbourne or Augusta National or Riviera? Well, there aren't many that can actually hold the event. And that is a big challenge, because now, you know, certainly since the advent of Tiger Woods, it's big business. And that's one of the things that gets that slide right through the cover, so to speak, when people talk about, why don't we just have it at better golf courses?
Well, you're right about that. It's the totality of the footprint oftentimes that dictates whether or not a golf course is up to PGA Tour standards. And Riviera is kind of interesting in that regard. It is absolutely landlocked. It sits in the middle of a neighborhood. I think it's technically in Brentwood, California, or very close to Brentwood. And, you know, it's just a very residential area that happens to house a brilliant golf course. Now, they've got a huge clubhouse that enables them to do an awful lot of corporate entertaining, and they put up sky boxes all over the place. Parking and transportation at Riviera is a real problem, and it's something that they've overcome and obviously had to deal with. But all of the aggravation and angst that comes with that is well worth it to be able to see most of the best of the world play on an absolutely brilliant golf course that's, you know, withstood the test of time. I think I heard 94 years, something like that, they've been playing this tournament.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. Well, obviously the golf course then also tends to bring out the best shot makers and the best players. And with Matt Kuchar leading by two over Harold Varner III and our new number one, Rory McIlroy, and another shot ahead of Adam Scott, it always brings out the best. As you look at that leaderboard, obviously McIlroy being the highlight reel, number one player in the world right now, how do you see it shaking out this weekend, Nuge?
You know, it's sometimes Matt Kuchar doesn't get the kind of respect and accolades that he deserves. He's a solid player. He's a very thoughtful and smart player. This is kind of the kind of golf course that lends itself to his style of play. But I, at the end of the day, we're not quite to St. Patrick's Day, but I'm going to go with the Irishman because Rory looks to be firing on all cylinders. I think he's in a better place mentally than he's been maybe at any point in his career as far as being married and settled down and knowing his place in the game. And he's also, as of this week, the number one player in the world. And I think there's motivation for him to go out and kind of put an exclamation point on that and prove to people that that wasn't a fluke, that wasn't an algorithm that got him there, that it was outstanding play over an extended period of time. So I can't take my eyes off of Rory this weekend.
Yeah, and I also sense that, you know, it's interesting, the media is really trying to extract this rivalry piece with he and Koepka, and he refuses to engage in it, although I'm absolutely certain it's bulletin board material for him. I agree with you. I think that this is going to be a statement year for Rory. I've predicted that he's going to win two majors this year, and it might be the last time he wins two majors in one season, but I sense that this is a statement year for McIlroy, and he firmly is going to put himself as arguably the greatest player ever from Europe and certainly the best player in this era. So that's very exciting for him. As you look at Tiger Woods, I would have to say that I've never seen, I shouldn't say never seen, it has been a long time since I've seen his swing look as fluid and with no hitches in it. Obviously, he didn't play well yesterday, and he's chosen not to play in the Mexico event next week, which was kind of not what most people thought, but we have to get used to this new schedule. But he looks really good, Nuge. And what do you take away from this this showing of Tiger Woods at Riviera?
Well, I think Tiger had two strikes against him this week before he ever hit his first tee shot. One, you got to play one round in the morning at Riviera, and in the morning it's really cold, it's really damp, and that's not a great cocktail if you're 40-something years old and you got a questionable back. And then secondly, he's the host, and so there's been a whole boatload of distractions for him, and I think it just kind of got in the way of him playing golf. He made the cut. He's probably not going to be in contention. This is, for as long as he's involved in this tournament, it's going to be difficult for him to juggle all of that and be a factor. I'm really quite surprised that he chose not to play next week because it's free world golf ranking points, if nothing else. And most of us thought and believed and many of us hoped that he was going to be representing the United States in the Olympics. To pass on free ranking points suggests to many of us that maybe the Olympics isn't quite as important to him as we may have thought. So it's a surprising decision. And also in the context of this contemplated Premier Golf League, really kind of causes people to ask the question, is the World Golf Championship Series doing what it's supposed to do? Because Tiger wasn't the only brand name that decided to pass on Mexico.
Yeah, I think the golf course It's interesting because there are some people that love it because it's so different. And obviously at 11,000 feet, it's definitely a challenge when it comes to how far you hit the golf ball. But I think it's also a very quirky golf course that some people feel like definitely doesn't suit their game. And with Koepka and Cantlay and Tiger not playing, and of course Phil's not even in it, I don't believe, there's a lot of big names that have decided not to play, and that is definitely something that the World Golf Championship Committee has to take into consideration as it pertains to the venues. Because isn't this the golf course that they moved from Doral to, Nuge?
Yeah, it is. And it was, you know, kind of an emergency situation when they had to bail from Doral, and in the month of March, where can you go? Your options are somewhat limited, and Mexico raised its hand, and so it happened. I think you're right. I think this golf course is much, much too quirky to host a World Golf Championship. I think they really have to figure out how they can move this event or one of the other World Golf Championships, Memphis or something. They've got to put one in Europe, and it ought to be in Great Britain somewhere. You can't have something called the World Golf Championships when three of the four or two of the four are played in the United States and three of the four are played in North America. It just it diminishes what you're trying to do here. They really need to put this on a great linkside golf course somewhere in Great Britain in the summertime and let the boys have at it.
No doubt. Nuge, how can my listeners get a copy of the Global Golf Post?
You can go to globalgolfpost.com and sign up for our free digital weekly golf magazine that's delivered every Monday morning at 7 a.m. Eastern time. Give you all the news from the week before in the game, both professional and amateur, men and women. And you can also subscribe to our new subscription product, GGP Plus, where we deliver every day original premium quality golf journalism that you can't find anywhere else with no advertising. Globalgolfpost.com. I think your listeners would love it.
Absolutely, they will. Nuge, thank you so much for moving up to my Ricky Henderson spot, and look forward to having you on again next week, buddy.
Cheers, Virgil. Thank you.
All right, buddy. Before we send off to a commercial break, I want to send out a special condolences to two of my, two families of mine that have been some of my largest supporters, both through radio and through golf. The Smith family, Stuart Smith and Chris Smith, lost their father, as well as Jimmy Griscom. So my condolences to their families. And I'm dedicating the show to them. We'll be right back for more Talking Golf. Stick around.
Hey, guys. Brett Doherty.
Welcome back, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. Instruction-heavy program today and book-heavy program today. So yeah, we're gonna make your game better one way or the other. And joining me now is the 2017 Illinois PGA Teacher of the Year, from Chicago, Illinois, actually from Northbrook. I used to teach golf a million years ago. Lewis Sauer. Lewis, how are you today, buddy?
I'm great. How are you?
I am doing wonderful. Well, in Chicago, it's not really playable yet, unless, of course, you're indoors and you have really the greatest technology as it pertains to helping people play golf indoors, the new TrackMan simulators, which, and their newest updates are really ridiculous. Do you find that has totally changed the game for your business, Lewis, and how and why?
Oh, for sure. Today it's, I think we've had the two coldest days we've had all year so far. And, you know, we got 30 people coming in today to come in and practice and work on their games, you know, at a time of the year where most people just put their clubs away. So, you know, using the TrackMan, there's so many things that you can learn this time of year, whether it's developing your motion or just understanding how far you carry your clubs to controlling the ball flight, you know, with the way that they can measure your path and face and where you hit it on the club face. I mean, it's really a great learning environment. I found that for people learning golf, just getting indoors and you can obviously see the ball flight on the TrackMan simulators, but it doesn't have the same impact when someone misses. You know, they put it into the screen, or, you know, it goes off to the side. It doesn't have the same visual impact as, like, if you're out on the range and you're taking a lesson and, you know, maybe your buddy's two spots over and you happen to top one and, you know, you get all self-conscious, you know. But I remember, like, Ricky Fowler, when he went to first went to Butch, he topped a bunch of shots, you know, and people don't realize that when you're working on stuff, you know, you're going to miss, and it's not really that big a deal.
It's amazing how the mind gets in the way of progress when you start to allow what you think other people are thinking about your game while you're progressing. That's one of the things that I love about indoor coaching is how it takes away the embarrassment, because every shot, no matter how good or bad it hits, goes about 12 feet and then falls to the ground and comes right back to you. That's a really important feature that I'd underestimated in my early part of my career. But I obviously, with the technology catching up to everything else, I mean, I don't think 5 years ago the TrackMan simulator situation was even close to being good enough. And now it's as close to lifelike as we can get. And it has definitely helped my game.
Yeah, it's a game changer. I mean, I remember when I first moved back to Chicago in 05, and we started turning the bag room into a teaching area in the winter. And, you know, we had video, and you'd get someone's swing to look nice, but you didn't know how the ball was coming off the club face totally. You know, it'd be like, it looked good, but it went into a net, and you'd come out in the spring and, you know, the ball was hooking too much or fading too much. And, you know, then you had to work on that stuff. So now you can do it. Oh, look how my movement's now impacting the ball flight.
Yeah. And I know there's so many things that I like to, let me get your insight on this. You know, TrackMan has definitely posted that the juice of competitive golf provides about 4%.
Mm.
And so what I do to help people understand how far they're going to hit it with the juice is I raise the elevation to the 4% number, so at about 2,000 feet, that allows me to demonstrate to them how different their ball flight's going to be compared to the elevation that you're currently at. So Nashville is like 535 feet off the ground.
Yeah.
So I'll raise it another 2,000 feet to get the 4% so that they can see what they're going to produce nervous and with the juice in them. And it's really fascinating to see. You know, 4% is 4%, but at 200 yards, that's 8 yards. But at 150, that's like 6. So you have to learn how to manipulate it. Plus, you can control the temperature, and obviously, you can't really do much with the wind, except they have a wind gauge that's amazing when it comes to producing the facts on how much the ball will curve, how much it'll go down and versus in. Do you find that helping people understand the elements that TrackMan allows us to use is the next level game changer, because it's more than just how far you hit it in a vacuum. It's the real world we got to be concerned about.
You know, I mean, as you see this, like the, I would say from maybe even a scratch golfer, which is a pretty good golfer, to that 20 handicapper, most of the time they don't know how far they actually carry the ball. Right. And then you add the elements of wind, and then they really don't understand it. Plus, the impact of a miss hit. I think all those elements play a part in it, right? How much does 10 miles an hour impact the carry distance, and then influenced by, you know, the constant miss hit the amateur golfer gets. I think that I agree with you. It's going to be another game changer of getting people more prepared for how to play the game in more of a controlled environment.
Very true. Well, one of the things that I'm fascinated by in your great record of coaching are some of the key drills and or beliefs that you put in your players to help them overcome, you know, as everybody dreams about how good they can be, at the end of the day, as they get closer to achieving that dream, whether it's winning a junior tournament, club championship, PGA Tour event, or, you know, just a regular guy's trip to Bandon Dunes for 4 days, coping with the nerves of about ready to reaching your dreams is really one of the harder pieces for us to crack. What are some of the keys for you to help people overcome the anticipation, anxiety, and nervousness that comes with coming close to reaching their dreams?
Well, I mean, I just had this conversation with one of my longtime students, Patrick Flavin. He Monday qualified into the Scottsdale Waste Management Open, and he got it back to even with 4 holes to play, and the 15th hole he had, you know, hybrid into the green, and he was so amped up, you know, and he knew that he was amped up, but he was trying to get himself back down. And sometimes, you know what, you got to get in that environment to taste it, to actually learn how to, you know, embrace it. And then learned to just deal with it, you know, and he thought it was like the greatest thing just to be in the environment. And that I'd say is number one, just like learn to embrace it. You may not pull off the shot, but you know, just love it. And I'd say we work a lot on that. It's just, you know, you can hit great shots being nervous. There's nothing wrong with being nervous. Sometimes it's like extra fuel to do something great. And, you know, we'll do certain things to help someone breathe and start to pay more attention to their thoughts with the focus band and the heart math training. But really, I think it's just framing the mindset that it's okay to be nervous. I mean, I think you have, I have, we've all been really nervous. And I think it's part of the fun of the game is seeing how you deal with that and trying to help people frame that it's an exciting time not to be scared.
Yeah, I think that one of the most important things for people to understand is that at the very beginning, people come see us and we're fixing, you know, the range guy. But soon as we put the golf swing kind of like where they want it, the first thing we want to do is see what the golf course does to them. And then we want to see what competition does to them. Because at the end of the day, who we're really trying to fix is the nervous guy. We're not trying to fix the guy who's not, you know, just gets out of the car and is going to go play with his buddies. We're trying to figure out how to help the guy who's trying to achieve. They wouldn't be there unless they're trying to achieve something. And that is that, to me, that's the ultimate fun piece, which is not fixing the golf swing as it looks on the, you know, as they come in for a lesson, but preparing them for the moment. And they have to have experienced it and struggled and or not done what they wanted to be able to get there. And I think that that is a spot on. If my listeners get a chance to get to Chicago to check you out, how can they find you?
Lewis Sauer Golf. I'm in Northbrook. You can find me on Instagram, Lewis Sauer Golf. And, you know, just shoot me a message. And, you know, if I can help you out, whether it's just giving you a tip through Instagram or email, I'd be happy to. But one last point on the getting people over those nerves. It's like, I think a big part of it is we try not to have them, you know, you have to do a certain amount of block practice so that you can gain that motion, but then changing it up where you're not hitting the same shot over and over again and seeing actually what you said is like people get nervous. Like they get that 50-yard shot after they've hit, you know, a few drivers. I mean, you got to learn how to adapt very quickly, and that's what, you know, playing golf is more like.
Yeah, absolutely. Adaptability is a critical function to being an elite player. An elite as in the best version of yourself.
Yeah.
Lewis, thank you so much for taking the time to join me on your out of a busy schedule that you have. And I look forward to having you on again really soon, buddy.
Yeah. Thank you. Have a good one.
My pleasure. All right. When we return, Nick Bradley's going to join us on the Orca Driving Range. Stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone.
Boxing fan.
Nobody said it was easy.
Welcome back. You are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. We're getting ready. We're having a little bit of technical difficulties with the phones here. We're going to have Nick on in just a second. But Nick Bradley, who is going to be my next guest, is really one of the greatest teachers in the world, and probably one of only about two or three teachers that I would go see if I was going to try to play again. Nick is one of the greatest authors of golf. His books, The Seven Laws of the Golf Swing, Kinetic Golf, and also his newest book, which is The Letters to the Evolving Golfer, 50 Essays, is truly one of the greatest books I've ever read. And it's so now we have Nick, and congratulations, Nick, on your newest book. And obviously, welcome to the golf Talking Golf. How you doing today, buddy?
I'm good, Virgil. You well?
I'm doing fantastic. Talk to me. Obviously, if I'm not the biggest fan of your books, I'm in the top five as it pertains to The Seven Laws of the Golf Swing and Kinetic Golf, and now your newest book. Did this new book just kind of fall in line with the volumes of you kind of went through the fundamentals of the mechanics, then you went through your second book was unbelievable visuals on how to access the talent that you put in. Is this newest book kind of the next level, or is it just something that was inspired through the years of teaching golf that you thought you wanted to put out there?
Yeah, I think as you go through your career as an instructor, I think that quite naturally you gravitate at the beginning to everything technical. And I think that's 100% correct, because I still maintain to the day that the golf swing or playing golf is a technical challenge first and then a mental challenge. So I think in the first part of your career, you definitely zero in on everything technical. And it's, you know, just a point to any young teachers out there listening, it's very important not to get pigeonholed into a certain methodology, which I think we've seen in the last decade or whatever. We've seen them come and go, and go, thank God. So I think that, you know, I think the big thing is that, as I say, you know, in the first part of your career, you're really into the technique side, which is fantastic. And I think as you mature and you really understand what works, but probably more importantly, what doesn't work, I think you morph into more sort of what's underneath the hood. And, you know, I think we know more about the golf swing now than we ever have done in the history of the game, due to biomechanics and measuring devices and radars and physiology and stuff like that. And I think that, for me, what fascinated me and, you know, led us to an evolving golfer is kind of the embodiment of it, is Jack Nicklaus was no fluke. Nick Faldo was no fluke. Tiger Woods is no fluke. Ben Hogan, in his period when he won 9 majors, no fluke. What I really wanted to know was what mindset, philosophies, and strategies did these golfers either blunder upon in some instances and absolutely by design in other instances? What did they have working for them during these purple patches, these incredible periods of performance? And led us to an evolving golfer expresses my work over 30 years taking golfers to world number one, European number one, juniors to world number four. It expresses everything that I've learned in 30 years in terms of what's underneath that hood. And I think that's what I'm excited about, because hopefully it's going to shorten everybody's learning curve.
It's fantastic. And I think that if there are three people that I'd like to pass that book on to, are Jordan Spieth, Francesco Molinari, and Justin Rose, somebody that you've worked with in the past. And although he is in contention this week at the Genesis, he's kind of been off form for a while, and Jordan Spieth looks about as lost as any human could be, and I'm not sure that Francesco Molinari has overcome the 12th hole at Augusta National from last year. When you look at those three players' current games, it's definitely not their physical, it's mostly in their mental, but they can't seem to access what they already know. What do you see out of those three guys, and what is it that you would be passing on to them in advice as it pertains to them getting back to greatness?
Well, I think for all three of them, a role model would be Rory McIlroy and what Rory has done in the last 12 months to 18 months, which is he has really looked underneath the hood. I mean, Rory McIlroy, when he's in flow, is, in my opinion, is the best golfer in the world by a long way. But he's slowly, what he's doing now, clearly, is he's finding out how he works from a neuroscience point of view, from a philosophical point of view. You know, he's really gone underneath the hood. And I think when you look at Justin, who, you know, I first worked with back in 2004, and then I did 3.5 years with him, helped into world number five and European number one. When you look at Rosie, well, you know, if there's two golfers from 2009 to 2019 that underperformed in majors, you would have to say it's Tiger Woods for all of the reasons we know. And the other one, for Justin Rose to come out with one major in that decade, is absolutely criminal. And his main problem is that he over-prepares, and he has a trust level that is very, you know, he has a bit suspicious trust level. He needs to make sure that every box is ticked. And if you go onto my Periscope, I actually talk about the difference between Justin Rose and Rory McIlroy, and you'll see the different sort of sequences they have to put in place to arrive at their best. But for Justin, you know, he needs to know that every box is ticked, every part of his team, every person on his team is really knowing what they're talking about, and it makes common sense, right?
Yeah.
Jordan Spieth is a different scenario, in my opinion. Jordan Spieth, as we know, has got a slightly quasi-technique. Now, Jordan Spieth was a junior phenom. He was a great player when he was 12, 13, 14, really good. And as you mature, as you get into your young 20s and what have you, you and I are of a certain age where we know that your physiology changes. And what he shouldn't be afraid of is that there are certain players in history who have, out of necessity, made swing changes. I'm thinking of Hogan. I'm thinking of Jack Nicklaus in 79. I'm thinking of Nick Faldo, 83, 85. I'm thinking about Tiger Woods. I'm thinking about Mark O'Meara. I'm thinking about Hal Sutton. Swing changes should not be feared, okay? If you're with an instructor who genuinely knows how to put the pieces together in a technical way, okay, you should look at that as a viable option. And for me, Jordan Spieth, what can we teach him about playing the game? Very little. He's strategically good. He's got a great caddy on the back. He's been playing golf since he was 12, 13 at a high level. Strategically, this guy's got everything. I'm sorry, but Jordan Spieth is breaking down technically. You only have to look at his statistics. His fairway hit, his distance is down, and his greens and regulation is down as well. He should not be afraid to pull apart all of these little pieces that, okay, sometimes come together as a really good whole, okay, but they are just too inconsistent, and all of the stars need to line up at the moment for Jordan to play well. And I just think there's a much easier way to do it, and it's something that he should not be afraid of. And as for Molinari, well, you know, Mark Fulcher is one of my best friends. I brought him on board to be Justin Rose's caddy, and I think what's happening in that camp is that expectations are going through the roof. We've got a new caddy. We've got a great caddy. Molinari is obviously excited. And I think what everyone starts to do is to over-try and, you know, start to move out of that that operandus modi where everything is kind of like flowing. In fact, actually, some of my research at the moment is why people change when they don't need to. Right? And I'm really researching it at the moment, and there's really good neuroscience behind why people change when they simply don't need to. And I think what's happening in that camp is that the new guys come on board, expectations are high, and people are just over-trying and not overflowing.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Very fascinating. I can't wait to see that research. That's going to be amazing. Final question for you as it pertains to this distance report from the USGA.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big chasm between the people who think the game needs to roll the ball back and bifurcate, and then there are people who are just like, the game is where it needs to be. What's your feeling on the distance report and where the game is going?
Well, I think for the people that are objecting to the RNA and the USGA report and the direction it seems to be heading, I would remind those people that, and they are, you know, generally professionals, I would remind those people there's not a profession in the world where you don't have what I call professional challenges, right? Does a pilot come into land and there's a crosswind and lands 5 miles before the runway and asks everyone to walk the rest of the way, right? Or does a plumber tell you to turn off the mains and go down to the local lake and wash while he's, you know, so this idea that, you know, especially with long putters, which was another indicator of this ability to shirk around the problem of professional challenges, okay, you've got to do it. And I feel that with the whole ball issue, that Brandel Chamblee is exactly right. There should be a set of rules for amateurs and a different set of playing rules for the professionals. And the reason being is the divide has never been bigger. And what I mean by that is, let's take the scenario in 4 or 5 years' time when amateurs are allowed to use different equipment to professionals. Now, let's say one of those amateurs gets to play in the Open Championship or qualifies for a US Open. The argument could be made that why are you using, why are you coming into a professional event using equipment that essentially is more high powered than the rollback of the equipment the professionals are now using? But let's look at that logically. Are those amateurs that are playing in the professional tournaments with their souped up equipment, do they have the trainers that professionals have? No. Do they have the instructors that the professionals have? Probably not. Do they, you know, so the professional game really has so much more intellectual property and perks than the amateur game. It really would make no difference at all. In fact, it would level out. I'm honestly, I thought that Augusta National, if this rule didn't happen, and who knows what goes on in the back rooms, by the way.
I thought
that in the next 2 to 3 years, Augusta National, because it's answerable to no organization, it is its own tournament. I really thought that they would bring out their own tournament ball just to stop the, you know, the abuse the golf course is getting from a scoring point of view. So in terms of the ball and all the other pieces of equipment, it's not just the ball, but I'm absolutely for a sort of NASCAR, same car, best driver wins philosophy. Yes, I am. I think that it's good. And I think the amateur game, you know, the amateur game should be about complete enjoyment and all of that good stuff. And there's only one person to blame or one organization to blame, and that is, well, there's two. Number one, the club-making companies that one day said, well, okay, let's make the game easier for the amateurs, but the amateur organizations like the RNA and the USGA unfortunately let that philosophy and that technology bleed into the professional game, and it should never have happened. It should never have happened. So I'm absolutely for the sort of parallel universe I hope that we're moving towards.
I love it. Nick, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come on my show. Obviously one of my favorite guests of all time, so thanks for doing that. Look forward to having you on again really soon, buddy.
Thanks, Virgil. Have a great day.
My pleasure. Well, we're going to finish strong with Dr. Rob Bell, so stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone.
Boxing fan.
It's time to finish strong, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. One of the things I find fascinating about Nick Bradley, as we're waiting for Dr. Rob Bell, is the guy is really a magician as it pertains to attaching visuals to technical prowess. And then he's really one of the best I've ever seen at being able to create visuals that allow the technique to come flowing out of your body instead of trying to mechanically do it. His book, Kinetic Golf, if you're ever looking for different ways to think about shots, from anything from a flop shot all the way to the highest draws and the lowest fades with your tee shot, totally amazing. I'm a gigantic fan, so I would encourage everybody to check that out. As it pertains to the lost version of Jordan Spieth, Francesco Molinari, and Justin Rose, it's something that I spend a lot of time trying to understand, which is how golf and or the people who are trying to compete at it at the highest level, they're bizarrely fragile while simultaneously being Bethlehem steel. And it's really weird. It's all confidence. And Dr. Bell always talks about confidence is king and talent's queen. And I just believe that what's happening there is and just like Nick Bradley said, the expectations that humans put on themselves once they achieve something is unfair and a cancer to performance. So I don't think there's any doubt that the biggest challenge that they're facing is Spieth, who is supposed to be the next Tiger, and Francesco Molinari was supposed to be the next European stud. So I find it fascinating to see where they're going to go. But joining me now is the honorary poobah of mental toughness in golf, Dr. Rob Bell. Doc, how are you today, buddy?
Good, Virgil. Man, I got stuck on a long run, buddy. I just got in.
Well, I appreciate the couple minutes that we're going to have. You got a new book coming out, P- Pukin Rally, which might be where you're about at right now.
Oh, talk to us
about Pukin Rally.
Man, it's basically not about the setbacks in life. It's about the comeback. You know, I mean, I think whenever we're, especially we're watching golf, man, I mean, there's going to be mistakes that happen. I mean, look at our champ last week. Look at Landry a couple weeks ago. I mean, he starts stumbling a little bit, right? But yep. It's not about the setback. It's about the comeback. And I just think, man, if we can maximize that skill in our life, then that's what's going to propel us to greatness. You know, the one thing is, man, is once we start going through the motions, once we start losing that belief in ourselves, we're not going to be able to rally. And that's the thing. Everybody pukes in life, right? No one's going through life without puking.
That's right.
But it's not about the setback. It's about the comeback.
What do you think the neurophysiology of the comeback is? Is it instilled in you at a young age, the grit and the perseverance, or is it trainable for those that maybe didn't grow up in an atmosphere that fostered perseverance?
Well, I think it's definitely trainable, and here's why. Because every successful person I've come across, Virgil, everyone had a situation or some external force that was telling them that they can't do it, that they're not good enough. And then why was every successful person, why did they have that? Because what it did is it galvanized the belief in themselves that I'll show you mentality. I don't think we can do that all the time, but that's what we kind of hear it. But it galvanized the belief in themselves because there was no other way. It's either a fish or cut bait moment. It's either, yeah, you're going to believe that negativity or you're going to believe in yourself. And that's the point about that's where it can always be learning, always be taught.
Yeah, we got about a minute and a half. I wanted to get your thoughts on the trials and tribulations of Justin Rose, Jordan Spieth, and Francesco Molinari. They've all kind of fallen off the face of the earth in the last 18 months as it pertains to their expected results. Expectations are a cancer, but what do you see out of those three? And if there was any advice you'd give them on how to break through, what would it be?
Man, I see each one being a little bit different, you know, but I mean, that's the thing. I think when you hit that level, if I was to pick one that was definitely going to come back, I'd still say it'd be Spieth, because we've seen it time and time again about how tough that guy is. And if we talk about Pukin Rally, I mean, look at what happened at the Masters and how he's able to come back at Royal Birkdale and have the best bogey of all time. And, you know, I mean, every situation is a little bit different, man. I think it just always gets back to our process and what we're trying to do and that belief in ourselves, man.
Yeah, it always comes back to the process. And it's when people get out of the process and into expectations that the wheels come flying off. And that's where I see all three of them in some ways are in that rut right there. Doc, how can my listeners get in touch with your great information and your newest book, Puke and Rally?
Yeah, man, it's going to be out this spring. Don't worry, buddy. You're going to be in it. And I'll get you a copy. And I apologize for being late today, man. That run went real long. And just drrobbell.com, man. I appreciate you, Virgil.
You're the best, man. Well, have a great week and look forward to having you on again really soon, man.
Thanks, bud.
Thank you for making us part of your Saturday morning. Excuse me, because without you, there is no talking golf. Have a wonderful Saturday. We'll see you next week.